Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk family, this is Leslie Gist. I'm the host of this show, the Antique E-Show, and we have a great show for you tonight. Tonight we have the founder and CEO of a black publishing company called Just Us Books. Mr. Wade Hudson is his name, and he is on the line right now, and I'm going to allow him to introduce himself to you tonight. So, sit back and take a listen.
How you doing, Leslie?
I'm doing great. It's so
good. Great
to have you on the line.
We've been talking about doing
this show for a couple of weeks.
That's exactly right. So we're finally doing it, right?
Great. Happy Father's Day.
Thank you so much. In fact, I just left dinner with my daughter, Keturah, and my son, Stefan, and my wife. So they treated me to dinner. My daughter actually cooked dinner. And so I'm now joining you.
Great. This is a wonderful occasion. It's Father's Day, and we thought that we would talk about how your books at your publishing company, Just Us Books, relate to Father's Day. Can you first give our audience a little bit of background information as to who you are and how you started your company, Just Us Books?
Yeah, well, first of all, Leslie, I grew up in the South, in Louisiana, and, you know, I grew up during the 1950s and the 60s and sort of came of age during the midst of the civil rights struggle. My roots are firmly planted in the Baptist tradition, and I grew up in the church, and I'm still involved in the church. I am a deacon at my church, Imani Baptist Church. And having said all of that to give you sort of a background of who I am, we started our company called Just Us Books, my wife Cheryl and I, in 1988. And, you know, the idea and the genesis for starting the company really it was sparked by, you know, our experiences growing up in the South. My wife grew up in Virginia, as I said. I grew up in Louisiana. We felt that there was a need for books for our children and young people that really highlighted and spotlighted the black struggle. There were very few books that were being published at the particular time, and the few books that were published often did not find their way onto the shelves of in bookstores. So we decided, rather than complain about the lack of these kinds of books that we felt were important, that we would take a step of faith, and that's what we actually did. We stepped out on faith. We only had a few thousand dollars to start our company, but we saw it in the beginning as a ministry, something that the Lord had given us. And so we stepped out on faith, and God has blessed us over the years. We've been doing this now. We're actually into our 21st year, and there have been ups and downs, but the Lord has been with us throughout it all, and we feel that we have made some significant contributions in the area of literacy and institution building. So we're blessed.
Now, I want to take you back to one of the most profound conversations you had with your wife.
Mm-hmm.
When you first decided, you know, there's a need and there's a niche in this area of Black literacy.
Yeah.
Do you remember, like, for instance,
I have a
problem with the Kill a Mockingbird.
Now,
that book really has stimulated and provoked me into doing certain things in the school where I work.
Okay.
There something like that or a book or some sort of experience that just says, you know what, I'm going to have to do something about the situation instead of complaining? Do you remember any
instance? Well, you know what, actually what happened, Leslie, we really looked high and low for books for our children that we could use to help them understand their history and our history and where we come from. And we had a lot of problems finding those books. So actually my wife created a group of characters called the Afrobets Kids. And initially they were used on T-shirts and posters and things like that. And then she came up with the idea for a book teaching the letters of the alphabet, utilizing African words and images from the African-American and African experiences. And it was called the Alphabet's ABC book, and that was the first book that we published. We published that book actually before we started our company, Just Us Books, as an entity. But we printed 5,000 copies of that book, and we did a really good marketing campaign to get the word out about it. So the 5,000 copies were sold in less than 3 months, and so we knew that we were on to something, and we knew that there were other African American parents who were looking for the kinds of books that we knew needed to be made available. So we were sitting at our dinner table one day when we actually just prayerfully considered taking the step to form a company, and we decided to do that, and we really didn't have to convince ourselves. We really felt at that time that we were called to do this by God, because, again, we see this Just Us Books as a business, but for us it is also a ministry. So we decided to take the step, and we were looking for a name, and, you know, I think I said, you know, well, it's Just Us, Cheryl, just the two of us, and that's how the name Just Us Books came about. And that's really how it happened. But, again, you know, we grew up, both of us, and particularly for myself, I grew up in Louisiana, and throughout my school years, from kindergarten through high school, there weren't any books that spoke to us about the African-American heritage or the African heritage at all. So the books that we had really didn't present our experiences to us. And we recognized after we had graduated from high school and gone to college how much we had not had in terms of understanding that history that and our culture that we came from, and we know how important it is once we started to really recognize all the important people and all the important contributions that our people have made throughout history, and how that really sort of helped to us to stand up erect and hold our heads up, because we were standing on a solid foundation. And we did not know that, at least I did not know that foundation going up, because the books that we had did not speak at all to any degree about the contributions that folks who look like me had made, you know. And we recognize that our kids need to know that history too. And that's why we started Just Us Books.
How old were your children when you published the Afrobets?
Oh, let's see. That was 88. Couture was around 12, and Stefan, I guess, was around 5 or 6 years of age. Actually, one of the characters, one of the characters is named Tura, after our daughter Keturah, and another one is Steph, named after Stefan. And the other four characters were named after children of friends of ours.
Now, where can we purchase your book? Because I have a three-year-old named Ashley.
Well,
and
actually,
I need your book.
Yeah, actually, the Alphabets ABC book is, all of our books are still in print. We have an online store, www.justusbooks.com. But our books can also be purchased at bookstores as well. Definitely from our online store. And again, all of our books, all of the books that we've published over the years, and we publish well over 100 titles, still are available and can be purchased.
Excellent. Now, the name Keturah, I don't want to get off base, but Keturah is very important in the book I wrote about the Steele family. Isn't that that's an African name, and it's from Guinea, isn't it? Isn't it a Guinea name?
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it's from South Africa. Keturah, her middle name is Jindayi, Keturah Jindayi, and it means, the two names together mean, it's all over, I feel better now.
Oh, what a wonderful, wonderful name, and she's featured in the book Afrobest. I think that's an excellent title.
Yes.
An excellent story for our listeners to hear, and it's inspiring to me. Now, prior to you entering into the publishing business and becoming authors, what was your experience in, what were your professions?
Well, my background is actually in public relations. I have worked, and I've also been a reporter for newspapers. I worked for a number of institutions in public relations. I worked at King College, King University now, Essex County College, and I also worked for the Newark Board of Education in public relations. And my wife's background has always been in publishing. She's worked for a number of publishing companies in the educational sector as well as the trade publishing area. So actually the experiences that we both have sort of meshed and have served us well as we've sort of built our company, Just Us Books. But I've always, you know, I really consider myself primarily a writer.
Okay.
And I have been writing ever since I was a little boy. I can remember sitting on the porch in Mansfield, Louisiana, where I was born, and 8, 9 years of age, writing poems and writing about the people I saw around me and writing about situations that I encountered. And I think that my writing is a gift from God. And when I speak to students around the country, when I have the opportunity to do so, which is quite often, I share with them that all of us have special gifts and talents that the Lord has given us, and it is our responsibility to find out what they are and to nurture and develop them, because those gifts, those talents, are going to allow us to make our important contributions to the world, you know. And so writing is one of mine, and I've tried to work at it and develop it and nurture it and take courses and read books so I can become better at writing.
Now, as a young person, did you have the opportunity to publish anything?
It's funny. What I did do, in Mansfield, Mansfield is a very agrarian town. Mm-hmm. The northern part of Louisiana, where I was born and raised, is what I guess during those days we call a country, you know.
Farmland?
Well, actually, you know, it's cotton was the primary crop there, So most of the economy was built around cotton. So people, you know, worked on farms and that kind of thing. And forestry was another part of the economy. But it was a very provincial kind of place, you know. So I there weren't a lot of professional blacks in the town. we had school teachers principally, and that was it. I don't recall there being a black lawyer nor a black doctor when I was growing up.
Well, when I say published, I don't mean like, you know, in a newspaper. Well, maybe a little town newspaper.
Well, what I was going to share with you is that I didn't really have a role model in terms of learning what publishing and all of that was about. Mm-hmm. But what I did do, I wrote a story, and I actually did three copies of that particular story, and I sold each copy for $1. And and so I guess that would be my first entree into publishing, and not really understanding what it was all about, because I didn't know at that time. I must have been like 9 or 10 years of age.
Right.
I didn't really know what that was all about, but that was a way for me to make money. I think the people in my hometown bought the copies to encourage me and to help to motivate me and inspire me to continue to write. But I was just sharing with you in terms of growing up that I think a number of our young people are in a similar kind of situation. They don't have the necessary role models or the mentors around from which to learn from. And I think that's one of the things that we really need to work on, those of us who have, quote, made it to some degree. We need to give back and be willing to be role models and mentors for those who don't necessarily have one. As I said earlier, I think God is a gracious and a generous God, and I think he's given all of us talents and gifts. And unfortunately, most of us don't really find out what they are, and therefore we don't use them.
Now, you found out your gift, and I think you attribute your learning about your gift to your relationship with God.
Oh, certainly, yeah,
so as
yeah.
A youngster, you were truly connected to God, right?
Yeah, exactly. I grew up in the church, and I understood at a young age, you know, how important Christ is, and Christ was a role model for me too. You know, again, we lived in, and it, segregation in Louisiana was like the worst. In this country is almost similar to apartheid in South Africa before Nelson Mandela came along. And, you know, it was two worlds. There was the black community and the white community. And very seldom did we see white people unless we went downtown. So it was a totally black world, totally self-contained world in which, you know, I had to live. And so it was very difficult, aspiring to something that you really can't identify as a young person growing up. I never knew that there was a Langston Hughes, a Ralph Ellison, all the other wonderful black writers who had come before me and who had created an enormous body of work. They didn't exist for me. So growing up as a little kid and writing, I felt really alone and lonely that nobody else was doing this, you know, because I didn't know about the wonderful black writers who had come before me. And I really didn't understand who these people were until my freshman year of college. And I almost had a heart attack when I found started reading the works of Langston Hughes and Richard Wright and Ellison and all the other Arnold Bontemps and all the other wonderful writers that I learned about.
Now, you said you went to a segregated school.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, does that mean that your teachers were also black, or does it mean
all of my teachers were black, and the books that we had generally were passed down from the white school. So that sort of tells you, give you an idea of what kind of books we actually had, and that they weren't going to reflect the African or the African American experience at all in any positive way. But it was a totally segregated school. All of the teachers were black, but we had some wonderful teachers. You know, we All of the equipment that was used in the school was again passed down from the white school. So it was tough, but our teachers cared about us, and they recognized, and I don't think we understood, or even they understood, that they were actually operating from W.E.B. Du Bois's talented tent philosophy. They looked to find the talented black students, and they really embraced them and really spent a lot of time with them, and I was considered one of those kids. So, got a lot from those black teachers, and many of them were like surrogate fathers and mothers for me. My mother and father were great parents, you know, but they only got, because of the environment, they only got as far as the fourth grade, you know. And so when I got to the fifth grade, I had obviously gotten further in school than they had, you know. So the
now,
teachers,
what role did the church play?
The church played a very important role in my upbringing. What the church did, and I think this is true for black folks for a long period of time, the church really was the central institution in the community. I mean, that's where I learned to speak before people. I had opportunities to pray and to sing and they had youth day where we actually had to speak, and I was a junior deacon and that kind of thing. So the church played a very important role in helping us to understand, first of all, that we were important, that we were valuable because we were a child of God and God loves us, but also that the people in our community, including our church people, cared and loved for us too. So in spite of the segregation, in spite of all of the Jim Crow laws and all of the negative stuff that was sort of bombarding us on a continuous basis, we felt loved and cared for, and I felt really safe. I felt safe in my environment, in my black community, or in the black church where I attended. Even though I knew that at any time a white person could come in and pluck me or my father or any of us from that environment and do whatever they wanted to do to us, but there still was a sense of peace and calmness, and that really came from the closeness of the folks in our community, including the church folks.
Okay. Now, when did you become aware? Now, you know, as a youngster, I don't think you realized that you were being isolated or you were living in segregation. When did you become aware of your living conditions of being segregated, and did you write about it as a youngster or as an adult?
Yeah, I certainly did as a youngster write about it, and I became aware of it, I think, probably during my junior high school years. And in fact, I wrote a letter in 1960, I believe it was, after John Kennedy was elected president, and his brother Robert Kennedy became the Attorney General of the country. And I actually wrote a letter to Robert Kennedy complaining about segregation and Jim Crow laws in Mansfield. And he actually responded to that letter and said that he and his brother were trying to do what they can to change things, and that change would be coming, you know. So, you know, I was aware of it, even though I didn't have the books. I really was not around people who were really talking about it. Now, during the midst of...
Can you repeat that? That was a very profound story you just told. You know, I'm a high school teacher, and I have no problem with repeating and repetition. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that one more time?
Yeah.
1960 and how old you were. Could you start right there?
Yeah, I think I must have been like 13 or 14, and I wrote a letter to Robert Kennedy, who was the Attorney General of the United States at the time, and complaining about Jim Crow laws in my hometown of Mansfield, Louisiana. And he actually responded to me, stating that he and his brother, John Kennedy, who was the president at the time, were trying to do all they can to change the conditions and that things would change. Well, I even wrote, I think the name of the Disney show was Spin and Marty. You know, but anyway, Walt Disney was very popular during that time, and he had a number of television shows, including the cartoons and all that. And I can remember writing a letter to the Walt Disney Company, complaining because they did not have any black folks on their programs, and I didn't get a response from that, but I did write. So I was acutely aware, you know, of segregation and the inequities and recognize that it was not right, you know, even at a young age. And I was going to say early on that even though people in my small town didn't really talk about the problems per se of segregation, but you still had in the mid-50s and in the early 60s, Dr. King and the civil rights movement was really picking up steam. So I started to pick up bits and pieces from the network television. They sort of filtered a lot of that stuff, the white establishment. So we didn't get a lot, you know. And I also got a little inkling of what was going on from Ebony Magazine and Jet Magazine. So I started to put all that together and make sense out of it myself, but it didn't really come full circle in terms of my really understanding what all of this was about until I went to college my freshman year, and I started reading everything that I could get my hands on, and then I started to really make sense of this whole struggle, you know, that didn't quite make sense to me growing up. You know, I knew that there was something wrong. I knew that black folks had worth and had value, you know, even though white folks were telling us that we did not. I knew that there was something wrong with that, you know.
Okay. Well, I have another question for you.
Sure.
You know, were you the only one in your neighborhood that was writing these letters as a teenager? And if you, and the second part of the question is, who were the people around you that knew you were writing these letters, and how did they affect your letter writing campaign at such a young age?
Well, I don't know if there were any other people writing these kinds of letters. I don't think so, but I don't know that for a fact. And to be honest with you, I did it alone. I mean, I didn't go to anybody and ask for advice on how to write the letter, or should I not write the letter, or should I write the letter. I did share the response that I got from Robert Kennedy with people in the community. And quite honestly, you know, a few of them were afraid, you know, because, you're going to cause trouble, you know. And now, during this time, you know, Dr. King was leading the civil rights struggle, and many people, particularly in small towns in the South, were very afraid because they feared what the white establishment would do to them, you know, because black people at this time had no power, you know, so white people could come in, hang a black, or shoot a black person, and nothing would be done about it, or fire you from your job, you know, and then you had no way to and the word gets around that you're a troublemaker, so you had no way of providing for your family. So a lot of black people were really afraid, you know, and that was one of the things that had to be overcome during the civil rights struggle. That is the fear that a lot of black people had.
Now, do you remember any specific people in the conversation that you had with your parents after you learned that some of your neighbors were a little bit worried about you receiving a letter from Kennedy?
You know, not specifically. I just think basically they sort of disavow themselves with it. Mm-hmm. You know, so if any trouble comes because of it, that they won't be in jeopardy because of it. I understand it now. You know,
okay.
Even though at that time, you know, I was couldn't really make sense out of it. But
How old were you again?
I must have been 13, 14 or so at the time. And but again, I mean, you know, the impetus for me doing this came essentially from my own understanding of the rights and wrongs,
right. Mm-hmm.
of Jim Crow and segregation, because nobody was talking to me about this. I mean, I had no mentor, you know, reading, you know, Richard Wright's Native Son, or reading some of you know, Du Bois books.
Now,
anything.
Do you regret not having Richard Wright? Even though
I wish I had. I mean, I had a late start, you know, of really appreciating what had gone on before me. I mean, I was like 17 when I went to college, and you know, as soon as I got there, you know, I went to the bookstore on campus and saw all these wonderful books, you know, that black people had written, you know, and I said, whoa, I mean, what is going on here, you know? I wish I had. I mean, I think now I had to do a lot of quick catching up, but I think, as the scripture says, you know, all things work together for those who believe. So I think I'm where I need to be now. So I'm not complaining about it. I mean, I think I wish I had, but I did not let not having it stop me from going where I needed to get to in my growth and my development.
Well, I'm fascinated by the story that you got a response from Kennedy at
yeah.
the age of 13.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I know that had to affect the decisions that you're currently making, and that the decisions you've made over the years in regards to what books you would publish. And moreover, that you probably learned the power of the pen.
Yeah, and also remembering that now helps me to understand who I am today and why I'm doing what I am doing today, not just in publishing, but in all areas of my life. You know, I've always been one to question things and to speak up for those who are dispossessed and those who need help. And I think some of that comes from, you know, my having been grounded in Christian principles, you know, and,
right.
and the examples of Christ, you know, looking out for the least of these. And so even now, if I see someone who's being mistreated or whatever, my heart goes out, you know, and I feel the urge and the need to try to help in any way I can and to speak up. Maybe that's something the Lord planted in me, you know.
And that's what I was alluding to when I asked you, do you regret it? Because I think that the textbook that you mastered was
mm-hmm.
the Bible.
Yeah.
And although you may not have had Richard Wright,
right.
It seems as though God wanted you to master the Bible, and that was the best book that you could have read.
That's it. No, you're so right.
You may have went in a different direction.
Right.
If you
right.
would have read something other than God's book, so
that's right. That's right.
You're
100% right, because that's the foundation. And you know, growing up as a lad in Mansfield, Bible study in our home every Wednesday night. You know, and youngsters and even sometimes adults would come from the community to share in that experience with us. And as we got older, you know, my brother and I, my brother Willie and I, would take turns conducting the Bible study session that we had. So the Bible, you're so right, was the foundation. And so in effect, what you're saying is the truth, because that's what I really needed at the time, and I got that.
And that's what is really, that's what you're exuding right now.
Yeah,
in all
yeah.
your works.
Yeah, you're so right. You're so right.
I can see it just as clearly in your conversation, in your work. And that leads me to the one of your latest projects that you're working on. Can you explain to the audience about
yes.
the Bibles?
Yeah, well, what happened about a year and a half ago, a little bit less maybe, my wife and I were approached by Zondervan Publishing Company, which is one of the largest Christian publishing companies in the world, actually. They were aware of our work with Just Us Books and multicultural literature in general. And so they approached us about putting together a proposal for a children's Bible. And they were looking for a Bible that would address the African-American worship experience for children. And we put together a proposal and sent it to them. And they said they would get back to us, but, you know, a few months passed, and we didn't hear anything. And a few more months passed, and we said, well, you know, maybe it's not going to happen. We eventually got a call back and said that they were very, very interested in the proposal. They were really excited about it. And the holdup was because they were changing editors, and they were bringing on new people on the staff of the imprint that would release the Bible. And so we continued to talk, and the new editor that they brought on board liked the proposal so much that she said, well, this can actually be two Bibles, one for children, and maybe we should do one for teens. And so that's what we did. We signed a contract to do both Bibles. So the children's Bible will be released in October of this year. We brought on board some of the top African-American artists to do renderings of some scenes from the Bible. Artists like Pat Cummins and Nancy DeVard and Shane Evans and Kathy Ann Johnson and Anna Rich and Javaka Steptoe and Michelle Woods. It's a whole list of a really wonderful top-notch African-American illustrators who are illustrating scenes from the Bible. And also what we do is give an overview for children. The Bible's aimed at kids 6 to 9 of the African-American worship experience. The other Bible is a Bible for teens. And we're really excited about this Bible because one thing that we find in our discussions with young people at schools and different occasions that we have to really interact with them is they don't really understand the faith that we profess to have. And I think to some degree we have not done a good job of really explaining what we believe so that our young people really understand it. So what we did with this, or what we are doing with this, because this Bible is due to be released in February, we posed about 50 questions that we thought young people would have about our faith, and we answer those questions using scripture and scriptural references as direct and honestly as we can. You know, for example, who and what is God? You know, and so we use scripture to explain who God is and what He expects of us. Yeah, yeah. I am that I am. Yeah, and he's the beginning and the end. But you know, and many of the adults who are followers, we use those terms, but we need to be able to explain those terms so our young people really understand them and embrace them. And the other thing that I've found too, at least in my experiences, is that a lot of us who go to church and have been going to church for years don't really know much about our faith as we really should know, you know, because I think perhaps we don't even ask some of the questions that we need to ask to learn more about what we believe and know more about who Christ is and what He expects of us and what He expects of from us in our relationships to each other. And that's really, you know, what it's all about. But we're excited about both Bibles, as I said, the Bible for teens will be out in February.
Will we be able to purchase these books? Yeah, you know, will you be having book signings?
We will be having book signings, and Zondervan has committed to do some heavy marketing and promotional work behind both of these Bibles. They've targeted a number of major cities where they will have some. We'll have some presence, and we certainly will be going to as many churches as possible, talking about the Bibles and you know, hopefully holding sessions where we can discuss the content of what we've included in the Bible.
I'm asking you to reserve my Bible today. I can't wait to see it released. I have two of my panelists on the phone. They've been for about 45 minutes, and I think they have questions or they just may be listening.
Okay.
I'm going to let David head on. David, are you there?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
hey, David. How you doing, David?
Happy Father's Day.
Okay.
Happy Father's Day to you. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
All right, David,
I want to.
David.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm also going to let, I want to introduce both of you at the same time so I don't have to interrupt you guys anymore. And we also have Dr. Metters. I think this is his number. Dr. Metters, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. So, David, you start off. Would you introduce yourself to Mr. Wade Hudson?
Yes, my name is David L. Hay, and I'm the former chairman of the TWU, Transport Workers Union Black History Committee, and I started my own foundation to ensure the legacies of African American will be, you know, was displayed and keep their legacy alive, to teach the youth about their history through arts and education. And I met Leslie at a book fair in Harlem. We've been going out together, and we've been supporting one another. And I'd like to applaud her for bringing on these people that can light our community that's doing things in a positive way, because we're all role models to a large extent. Each of us impact each other's lives, whether it's in a big effect or small effect, we know it or not. And you're making a very good impact on our youth, and I want to applaud you, and I would like to applaud Leslie for bringing you on.
Thank you. Thank you so much, David.
Oh, David, stop. Dr. Metters, you want to introduce yourself to Mr. Hudson?
Oh, yeah. I'm a professor at William Patterson University for the last 20 years, and I'm interested in history as well as a weapon to help to liberate us. And I'm very interested in your whole question of Christianity and how you use that as a tool to help enlighten us, the black population.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a lot of different discussions with Leslie and other people because I'm not really, you know, a Christian-like person, but I respect it, and I respect those who are involved in it. My problem basically would be the historical aspect of it, because I teach Western Civ.
Yeah.
Crazy as it may seem, but we have to go into how Christianity came into existence historically. And I found a lot of the students who were Christians are not familiar with just the basic history of Christianity and how it came into existence, especially starting with the Jewish community, the Hebrews, and the whole question about the Jewish community with the Zealot, with the Sadducees, and you know, Pharisees and the Essenes and all stuff like that, and how that grew, how that, you know, that came into existence, you know, during the Roman Empire, because they don't know anything about Roman history.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said that sometimes it's good to be spiritual. Nothing wrong with that, and believe in Christ, but I think you should have some historical background about how Christianity came into existence. Then on top of that,
I think Mr. Hudson just explained that he posed about, you said 50 questions?
Several questions. In fact, we do deal with the history, and I think there's a difference. When you start recognizing the history, and I understand where you're coming from, Dr. Meadows, so what it really boils down to a large degree is the misuse of the principles because I'm a Christian, so I believe in the teachings of Christ, although the Old Testament is a part of that package. But the message of Christ, now, white people have used, and other folks as well, not just white people, have used or misused Christianity for a self-serving kind of thing. And it's the way I see it, we have to look for our own meaning and interpretation in it for ourselves. And in doing that, we must also recognize how it has been misused in order for us to appreciate all the positive things that it has to offer.
Mm-hmm. Right. I agree with you 100%. I was just, again, real quick, I don't want to beat a dead horse. You're right about the historical thing. Thank you very much. My thing is, after we got past Rome, and then after Rome was over, and then we moved into, you know, the history of how Europeans, you know, European civilization came into existence, and had a lot to do with this whole question of these German tribes came to existence, you know, and how they came up and they built their country, Germany, and how Luther and all of those people came to existence. And I said to myself, okay, how did we as black people become Christians? And because that wasn't rooted in Africa as such, you know. It was rooted over there, I assume, in, let's say, more Protestantism with Lutheranism came with Luther.
Right.
So how you're a black person, how did you become Lutheranism? How did you come to go to a church called a Lutheran?
Well, let me interrupt you and share this with you, and then we'll move to something else. Now, see, I think, you know, we need to embrace all of our history. Now, when we look at the Middle East, what has happened is that they have taken Northern Africa out of Africa in those old maps and put it in the Middle East. So, Christ, what did Joseph go to? Where did he flee to when Christ was born to avoid Christ being killed? He went to Egypt. He went to Egypt, you know. So what I'm saying, and there are other Africans who have played a role in the development of Christianity. So we do have a stake and an involvement in that. What we've allowed to happen, we've allowed white people to whitenize Christianity, and it's not a quote white religion.
Right.
You know, Christianity is for all of us. And so our responsibility, I think, Dr. Meadows, is that we need to continue to define and redefine, you know, what Christianity really means to us and how it can help us move forward in 2009. You know, I think there are a lot of ways that it certainly has helped me in my walk, in my journey. And if you really think about some of the traditional African concepts and the sense of community and all of that, that's Christianity too. That's Christianity too, because, you know, this whole thing of where Christ said, you know, the two most important commandments, the number one, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and soul, and the second one is to love thy neighbor as thyself. That's community. That's having respect for others within your environment, within your community. And that's an African principle too. That's an African principle. So I think that we need to look at it in a different kind of way and not look at it totally as victims of it, that the way white folks sort of pushed it down our throats, but we need to look at it as recipients of the goodness and the graces that it presents to us.
Mm-hmm. All right.
You hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, Leslie.
I'm here.
Are you there, Leslie?
Yes,
don't
I
block
am.
For him. Let me have him by myself. Don't block for him. Let me see what he had to say, because I hear you getting ready. You know, I know you're deep into Christianity. I'm not going to let him let him hear what he had to say.
Okay.
All the other speakers have always been Christian-driven, and no problem with that. I respect that, and Leslie and everything like that. I always would like to, you know, keep a little thing about, you know, be careful, you know, about, I'm just careful about just not looking at everything just based on belief without some type of historical research. And I'm not saying that the Africans didn't contribute to it. Of course, you're right 100%. But the historical thing, they'll go back to look at it historically, you know, helps you be more precise in terms of your beliefs, I would think. Would you not?
I'm sorry. I missed part of what your last part of you said.
Yeah, I was just trying to say the historical thing would make you be more precise, because during the slave trade, you know, millions of us came over here to America, and I don't know how many came here were Christians. But whatever is the fact,
that's
we were
true,
waiting,
yeah.
were,
sure.
the people who were waiting for us on, you know, in South Carolina, North Carolina, were Christians, and they were about up to no good. And then one of the weapons they were using against us was Christianity. Now, some of the blacks, again, did just what you did, took the goodness and the beauty of Christianity and used it as an ideological tool to help escape from the rigors of slavery or chattel slavery. They helped it.
Mm-hmm.
And then some used it, then the slave master used it as a weapon to keep us in slavery.
Right.
So there's like a two-edged sword. Sometimes the Christianity can be used against you to keep you in check, and then sometimes Christianity could be used to help liberate you. That's in Frederick Douglass's book.
I don't disagree with that. You're 100% right. We can't argue with the history of how Christianity has been misused, and it has been misused. But I'll leave you with this. I met a brother, must have been a couple of years ago now, at a conference, and he had been involved in the civil rights movement for a number of years, like I have. And he is now a deacon of his church. And he was, you know, in the earlier days of the civil rights movement, he became almost an atheist, you know. But he's now back in the church. He's a deacon. He's totally embraced Christianity. But one thing he said to me in terms of understanding this whole thing, he said, when the Constitution was written, black folks really were not included. If we were included as 3/5 of a citizens
right.
of a man, that, you know, that whole
right.
that whole thing. But by and large, we were not included. But God and His infinite wisdom. Now the white folks may have not included us, but God and His infinite wisdom allowed them to create something that we are now a part of, or that now applies to us. So my point is, sometimes people, and this is a Christian principle too. Sometimes people take things and set things up that they mean to cause harm, and it may cause harm initially and for a period of time, but God can take that same thing and turn it around and make it be an instrument of good.
I agree 100%.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Metis, for the question, and thank you for your response, Mr. Hudson.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Metis.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, I would love to meet you, and then we can talk further.
Yeah, we can definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, we get to go into the books and get to the Bible. I love Christianity and teaching and everything like that, but I just want the students basically to have an historical backdrop. So one of the reasons I'm looking for, I don't want people to get caught up in what we call these little cults. I don't know how old you was, but back in that day, we had these cults. They're not that many companies taking people in and, you know, brainwashing them and making them do things that they shouldn't do, you know, as people and robots. You know, so just open your mind. You can still become a Christian. You can still read.
Yeah,
you can still read different books
yeah.
about different things.
Yeah,
think for yourself.
And then we'll end it here. Again, you know, it really is about, and we in our Sunday school class we talked about this morning. It really is about your personal relationship with Christ, with God through Christ. And your responsibility is what you just said. Our responsibility as a Christian is to read the Word and to learn as much as we can, because I believe, and this is part of my faith, that when we all call to judgment, you know, and God asks you for what you've done, you can't tell him, well, I did what Jim Jones told me to do.
Good point.
You know, it's what you did, and we all have a mind. God has given us a mind, so we are supposed to read. We're supposed to establish our own personal relationship with Christ, and that's what you mentioned Martin Luther. That's what Martin Luther did. You know, because before Martin Luther, the way the Catholic Church was set up, you have the priests and the Pope and all, and so you had this hierarchy that they said God came through them to get to the average person. And what Martin Luther said was, no. We can all have our own personal relationship with God, and how can we have that? Through Christ. That's why Christ came, so that we can have our own personal relationship with God. So we don't have to go through, you know, like it used to be in the Old Testament with the Sadducees and the Pharisees and all those
right.
folks who were the church
yeah.
leaders. You can have your own personal relationship with Christ. And that's what whenever I talk to people, I say, you know, that's what it's all about, establishing your own personal relationship, because we all going to be held an account, so we can't say, as I said, Jim Jones told me this, you know, or whatever, you know, because we have years ago, the Bible wasn't available, books weren't available to the average person. But now you can get the history, you can get the Bible to learn as much as you desire, you know, and it's our responsibility to do that.
Right.
I don't know if you were on the line when Mr. Hudson talked about, as a young boy at 13, that he loved justice so much that he wrote a letter to Kennedy. Tell him the story.
Yeah. I was sharing that. Well, as a sort of back up a little bit, you know, I grew up in a little small town in Louisiana, and you know, very very segregated town, and almost like apartheid in South Africa when I was growing up. And you know, Jim Crow laws all over the place, you know. But I knew that there was something wrong with that, even though, you know, black folks were forced to accept those laws and those practices. But I felt so inspired to speak up about it that I wrote a letter, you know, to Robert Kennedy, who was then the Attorney General of the United States, asking him to do something about, you know, the conditions in Mansfield, and he did reply to that letter. He sent a letter back to me. Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
And that's, you know, that was a little kid doing that, you know.
Yeah, you was way ahead of your time.
Yeah, bro. That's right. That's right.
Ahead
that's
of your
right.
time. I was even thinking about that. I was out there playing baseball. You was already your age.
Yeah, I did that too. I did that too.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's
yeah.
good. No problem.
Okay.
All right,
take care,
so
bro.
We're gonna move
care,
on to another segment. And David, do you have a yeah. question before we move to another topic?
No, it was just enjoyable to hear these two men speak about our history, about the ministry. And this is some powerful messages that our community need to hear. It's an ongoing thing. It's very therapeutic. We've been damaged to a large degree psychologically.
Yep. Yep.
And we're still in economic bondage in America. But we must remain positive.
Yep.
We must remain and proactive.
Yep.
Everybody can play impact. We
yep.
cannot change the past, but we can all help shape the future.
That's right,
and
Rob.
Each of us is what I've been doing in my little way, putting together this foundation to go out in the cities to speak to the youth
mm-hmm,
and to
mm-hmm.
get them involved in different interdisciplinary projects that I've began to form, and so they can share in learning about the history and playing a part at the same time. Through
yeah, David, where are you located, David?
I'm located in Queens.
Okay.
South Jamaica, Queens. I'm getting
okay.
ready to retire next year from the Transit Authority, and I'm going to I have the freedom to indulge my energies and into the project 100%.
Okay.
And I've been doing it partially now, and I have a project called the Granville T. Woods Project that I've been working on for 12 years.
Okay.
And
yeah.
It's really starting to blossom. The New York City Transit Authority president has given me permission to cooperate with the New York City Transit Creative Production Team on the documentary for Granville T. Woods. I just received an affirmative by the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center to write the foreword for my book,
okay.
And also they're also interested in me presenting the project out in Cincinnati.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Yeah,
where Granville T. Woods began his inventive career. So
right.
I use the project as a tool to motivate the children and also to get them to recognize that they're proud, golden legacy of our heritage.
Well, let's stay in contact. Leslie knows how to get in contact with me. I would certainly like to remain in contact with you, brother.
Yes, I would love to. I come out. I have a costume of the contemporary period of Granville T. Woods, and I come out as Granville T. Woods. I only speak about him, but I
okay.
become the man himself.
Okay.
And I have
okay.
So much material, and I have an exhibit that the MTA has recognized my material. They made 4 million picture cards based upon my illustrative book, and
okay.
they made an exhibit. For
2004,
since
okay, David.
On.
David, I'm gonna. David,
yes.
You want to put your number out in on the line?
Yes,
so that,
this is for Mr. Hudson. Any other person that would like me to come out with the Granville T. Woods Project? It's more than just a book. It's much, much more
okay.
about
okay.
our history. It's my number is 917-517-1770.
Say it slower one more time, baby.
917-517-1770.
Okay.
Or the DLH Foundation at nyc.rr.com.
Okay, so we're going to move on to the next segment
okay.
of questions. We're down to 27 minutes. That went really,
okay.
really
nice
fast.
Chatting with you, David.
Okay. He
oh, you hung up. Okay.
Okay. What I want to talk to you about next was how we met. Number one, and one of the most popular projects you're working on, which is with Omar Tyree.
Yeah.
I have his video
okay.
from your website
okay.
on the on my page, on the Blog Talk Radio page. So if the listeners would like to go to that page and watch an excerpt of Mr. Omar Tyree reading
mm-hmm.
to young African-American boys, looks like he's at a library.
Yes.
At a book
yes.
signing.
Yes.
And I thought that was such a powerful image here on Father's Day.
Mm-hmm,
it was
mm-hmm,
very appropriate
mm-hmm.
to talk about him and your relationship with Omar Tyree and the youngsters. Do you want to go into depth about
yeah,
that
well,
project?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the major challenges that we have today is getting boys to read. Not only just getting boys to read, but in the educational system, boys tend to fall between the cracks more quickly than girls. And it is said that if you don't get a boy, particularly a black boy, engaged in the school process by third, no later than fourth grade, that you're going to lose him. And usually that boy will drop out before finishing high school, and sometimes before even getting to high school. So our big challenge is to find ways to engage and to help our boys understand the importance of education and the importance of learning in general. Omar Tyree came to us. He has two boys himself, and I think he noticed, you know, how difficult it was to get his two sons to read. And one of the things he said he noticed, and obviously we've noticed this as well, is that many of the books that are published for young people and children don't really relate well to boys. Even some of the covers, for example, have images graphics that really appeal more to girls. And then once you open the book, the stories tend to be of more interest to girls. So Omar said he wanted to write some books that he felt would appeal to young boys of color, and particularly black boys. And he came to us with the idea. Now, Omar is, as you know, a celebrated author of urban fiction, and he's done extremely well. He's published by Simon & Schuster, and I think another book was published by Wiley, or will be published by Wiley. So he's been published by the large companies. But he sought us out because he felt that we would bring the sensitivity and the understanding to really help the manuscript that he was working on come alive and really fashion something that would relate and appeal to black boys. So his idea was to do 12 short stories featuring different black boys in each story. And he submitted the manuscripts to us, and we worked with him on that process. And he, again, he's an urban fiction writer. He's written mostly for adults. But I think he did a wonderful job on this manuscript, and we certainly worked with him and helped him understand what is required to write for the children and young adult market. And so the result is 12 Brown Boys, and that book is doing extremely well. It's well-received. Boys are reading it. We're getting letters from parents and from students who really are engaged by the stories that Omar has written. And he's become a really dear friend of Just Us Books, and in fact, we were with him. I think I saw you at Book Expo, Leslie. Weren't you there?
Yes, I was there.
Yeah, and I think you maybe met Omar. So Omar was there. We brought him to Book Expo, and Book Expo is the big convention for the publishing industry, and that they probably had 25,000 people there. But we brought Omar there, and he did an autograph signing, and he autographed all of the books that we brought for him to sign, and also he met people on the floor of the convention. But he's become a really dear friend of Just Us Books, and we now in negotiation to sign him up to do another book or follow up to 12 Brown Boys. So that's the story with Omar. So I would encourage those parents and even teachers who are looking for stories that really appeal to the middle grade students, and particularly boys, in say grades 4 to 6, to consider 12 Brown Boys, and I can almost guarantee you that the boys will relate to the characters in these 12 stories, and they will be encouraged to want to read. So, because I think once we get boys interested in reading something, then we can take that next step and really get them hooked so that they can start to read, obviously for necessity because they have to do a term paper or whatever, but we want to get them to read because they enjoy reading. They enjoy that reading experience. There's something about sitting down with a book. I mean, television, you know, has its positive points and negative as well, obviously computer and all that. But there's something about sitting down with a book that's your book, you know, and using your mind's eye, your brains as you read those words and creating those images in your own mind of what the writer is trying to get you to connect with. I mean, that's something, you know, you can't get anywhere. When you're watching television, the images are there for you. You know, the dialogue, everything is there for you. You don't really have to do any work or invest anything other than your time. But when you're reading a book, you have to really get into it, you know, and there's something really personal about that. So I think books, even though books have been challenged in many ways now with other kinds of mediums and formats, but I think because of that personal engagement, that personal kind of connection, that books will always remain valuable and something that people will appreciate.
Well, I'm a teacher, mm-hmm. and I teach mainly boys. I teach electronics.
Okay.
And I
really?
Find that, I find that the young men, they don't like to read books for entertainment.
That's right. That's
they
right.
They only like to read for a purpose,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
to get a job done, a task done.
Yep, yep, yep.
So I was talking to my husband about the same problem, you know, trying to find a way to get a book which combines an activity.
Right.
At the same time, it's offering some kind of technical learning skills,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
allowing
mm-hmm.
them to exercise.
Yep, yep.
It has to be a reward at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because they won't, you know, I won't say won't, but it's very difficult to have them engage into a reading project just solely for the purpose of entertainment.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't like essays.
Right,
because
right.
those essays and stories are more appealing to the young women or the female students.
Right, right, right.
Whereas,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think another way to get boys engaged, though, is boys love to talk, man. Mm-hmm. And if you have a book discussion after having read the book and get the boys to talk about what they've read and to relate the story or the characters to their lives, you know, that you can really start to get them. You know, they start to see the connection. But you're so right. I mean, girls can sit for a longer period of time. Obviously, boys are more active and they're more activity-oriented, so they want to move about. And in fact, I was talking to a teacher who was sharing with me that oftentimes what happens in a classroom setting when you have boys and girls, the girls can usually sit for the 40 minutes or the 50 minutes for the classroom session, and boys want to move about. I mean, after 10 or 15 minutes, they want to move around in the seat and stand up. And so the teacher, most teachers spend a lot of the classroom time trying to get the boys to sit and be quiet, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's really almost like going against their nature to some extent. I'm not saying they
right.
should not be quiet, but I think that's why in some school districts they are sort of looking at having classes or even schools based on gender, you know, girls together and boys together. And some of the findings in those schools and those kind of situations are that the girls and the boys both concentrate more in an all-girls setting and an all-boys setting. And boys tend to open up more in an all-boys setting than they
now,
do
now, in your personal experience, your own children, did you send them to schools, private schools, or any
Well,
any
my actually, my daughter went to public school. My son, hello?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. My daughter went to public school. My son went to public school for a few years, and then he went to a private school. You know, and I think the problem is really not a matter of private versus public as much as it's the approach to teaching and the recognition of the differences between the genders, you know, how boys respond to the teaching process and how girls respond to the teaching process, you know, and it's a complex kind of issue because I know a lot of people have a problem with segregating schools by gender, you know, and I can certainly understand that part of it because schools used to be that way, you know, years and years and years ago. Schools used to be segregated. Girls went to girls' schools and boys went to mostly boys' schools. And the co-ed educational thing is I won't say rather new, but it's sort of evolved into a co-educational concept. But I think it's worth looking at because we do have to find ways that we can keep our boys in school, you know, and find ways to to prevent us from losing them, because we lose so many of our boys, and particularly boys of color, you know.
Right. Now, homeschooling, are you getting any support from the homeschoolers, or do you even market to them?
Yeah, not on an organized level, but we have, you know, individual parents who are homeschooling who will buy books, will email us, you know, actual information for resources, a list of resources and things like that, but not on an organized level. But I do know that there are a number of homeschooling organizations and associations around the country, and that's a growing phenomenon. I think there are a lot more parents who are now starting to homeschool, but the challenge there is, first of all, the proficiency of the parents as teachers, and the other part of that is having a curriculum and getting the resources that's necessary. That obviously in an organized school setting, those things are provided.
So, have you thought about expanding into that market?
Well, yeah, we certainly are open to do that, and our books are always available to be used by parents who are homeschool. Again, we would probably need to, from a marketing standpoint, we would need to look at the various associations and groups around the country so that we can market our books more effectively to them. Because schools have, you know, curriculum committees and all of that, so you can make a presentation to a curriculum committee of the Board of Ed for a particular school district, and they either say, yes, we like these books, or we don't, you know, or whatever. But it's a little bit more difficult to do that with homeschool parents.
Now, could you repeat that?
No, I was saying,
as a company, you would go to the Board of Ed and market your books?
Yeah, well, you know, we sell to schools, you know, the way the it works with schools is that, you know, you have to get a contract with the school district to do business with them, and then, you know, they will give you a vendor number once you have a contract, and then you can make presentations to the appropriate committee or the appropriate person, and they can, you know, purchase your books if they feel they are relevant to their curriculum, they'll say no, you know. So, but most schools have curriculum committees, and they have departments where people, you know, make decisions on what they will purchase in terms of resources, whether they're books or other kinds of resources for schools.
Now, how has the charter school received you?
Very well. We in fact, many of the orders that we get now are from charter schools around the country. We get a lot of requests for speaking engagements from a lot of charter schools around the country, too. The charter schools, many of them are more progressive I don't want to say more focused, but I think that they have, I think, a greater understanding because, for example, our church, there's a charter school that's housed at our church. Our church has a school building, and the charter school is called the Pride Academy, and it has students from grades 6 through 5 through 8, I believe it is, and there are about 240 students, and they're doing a wonderful job there, and I think that there's more flexibility and leeway to develop a curriculum based on what the organizers of the school deem necessary. Now they still must adhere to certain state guidelines and that kind of thing, but there is more, a little bit more flexibility than there would be at some of the public schools. Many of the charter schools around the country are a little bit more open, and I think perhaps they even would allocate more revenue or resources to things like bringing in authors, bringing in people with experience and expertise to share with the students.
Okay. Do you have any plans to attend the NJEA Convention Center?
You know, we do that every year. We have attended the New Jersey Education Association Convention every year since we started Just Us Books, actually. I think the second year of our existence, we attended the NJEA, and we've been doing that ever since. And that's one of our big conferences that we attend during the year. We do a number of conferences and conventions during the year, and that certainly is one of them.
Now, do you offer CEUs for the teachers? Do you have workshops?
You know, we've never done a workshop, and that's probably something that we need to look to do. What we've done basically is to exhibit, to show our resources, but we've never done a workshop at NJEA. Now, we've done workshops at other educational conferences and conventions, like, for example, we've done several at the Maryland Teachers Association Convention in Maryland, and some others around the country, but never at NJEA. Maybe we'll look into it for this year.
Okay. Now, do you know of any organizations, African-American teaching organizations?
Yeah. One big one is the NAPSE, the National Association for Black School Educators. They have an annual convention every year, and it's well attended. You know, thousands of folks who come, and it's an organization of black school leaders. You know, superintendents, principals, and it's again, it's well attended. And they do a lot of work, and as an association, they advocate on behalf of black school educators on a national level, and then there are also local chapters of that as well.
We're down to our last 7 minutes. Do you believe
okay.
that?
Yeah. I've enjoyed this.
Okay, enjoyed I knew
this.
When we met, didn't we say we were going to
yeah,
have a good time
that.
Today?
Yeah, we said that. Yep,
and I didn't even get to ask the questions that I wanted to ask when we talked about when we met. But we'll meet. We'll have another show to talk about your poet book.
Okay.
But we'll stay on track with the educational questions.
Okay.
I had one about the Amistad Commission. When we met in Philadelphia, you were telling me. I'll let you explain to the audience. Explain the Amistad Commission and your affiliation with it.
Well, you know, we had contact with the commission not over the last year or so, because there have been some changes there in leadership. But we had a good relationship when I've forgotten the sister's name who headed it when we were working with them. But
could you explain
what
the Amistad Commission is?
I'm sorry?
Could you explain what the Amistad Commission
is? Well, the Amistad Commission is an advocacy group that was actually organized and is supported by the state of New Jersey. And the purpose of the commission is to integrate black history into the school curriculum of schools around around the state. And they've had a number of initiatives, sharing resources with teachers around the state at different venues and different cities. It's a good idea. I do think, though, that not to knock it, but to integrate Black history into the curriculum could be fool's gold, in the sense that if it's not done correctly, then the Black history will get lost, as it often does within the general curriculum. So I don't know if that's the most appropriate way to make sure that all of our students have a general understanding of Black history and appreciation for Black history. I think in many of the textbooks that are out now and in past years, they have, little snippets of Black history that are sort of thrown in. But it's difficult for Black students as well as white students to get a general appreciation for the important role and contributions that African Americans have made to the development of this country, but also to world civilization. And when you talk about incorporating it within the general curriculum, who's to say how much of the general curriculum should it be, and if it's not enough where the student can really get an appreciation for the history and an understanding of that history, then it sort of defeats the purpose. And I know that they're working on it. I have not really spoken with anybody over the last year or so, so they may be taking some other steps to do that. But I think it's important to share with teachers that history so that they, even if they're not within the curriculum or the textbooks that are being used, the teachers can then be equipped with an understanding that they can then bring with them in the classroom to help students understand that all people have played important and significant roles in the development of our country and the world.
All right, last question.
Mm-hmm.
Obama's presidency is extremely historical.
Yes.
How is your company addressing this historic event that we are now experiencing? Because, if we don't take care of that story,
it will be hampered
with.
Yeah, there are tons and tons of books that have been published about the president and his family and his significance. I think that the most important thing that we can do at Just Us Books, and I think we are doing that, is that whenever we have the opportunity to speak to students, to parents, to groups of people, that we help them understand the perspective from which he comes, and the how important it is to recognize that where he is and where we are now is a result of a lot of work and struggle to get to this point. And sometimes that is lost. And if we don't understand the history of how we got to this point, we can easily lose this victory.
Published any books about Obama, or are you planning?
No. We have not. We're looking at several manuscripts. And again, the problem is one of marketing. The marketplace is just inundated with those books. So it's very difficult to get shelf space or to get noticed because there are so many out there. For example, at Book Expo, which was held recently in New York, I mean, you can walk around and see, you know, almost every publishing company had books or posters about Barack Obama. And the I won't say scary thing about it, but the thing to be cautious about is not to get caught up in just that one victory. Mm-hmm. It's important. I mean, it is important. It is like one of the most important steps that we made as a country and as a people. But it's a part of a continuum. You know, it's like there's no Barack Obama without Dr. Martin Luther King, and there's no, you know, without Malcolm X or without Rosa Parks or without W.E.B. Du Bois and without Frederick Douglass, and we can go on and on and on, without Daniel Payne and all these people, and also white people who have struggled too for freedom. So it's important that whole story be told, and it's like a march, you know. You start at a certain point, and you keep marching on that journey, and we're at another signature stop or signpost on that journey, and this is where we are now. And, you know, 20, 30 years from now, there will be something else as we continue to move and progress.
Okay, now we are no longer streaming live on the Internet,
but okay.
We're still being recorded. And
okay.
I don't mind, because what I do is I take the recording and I edit it, and I'll make two or three shows out of this show.
Okay.
Dr. Metters, do you have any parting words or any questions for Mr.
Yeah, I have parting words, but I can't get a word edgewise in 26 minutes, and now you just call me and ask me a question.
I didn't know you were still on the line. Hello?
Did they disconnect him?
Yeah, I didn't know he was still on the line.
He's gone now.
Yeah.
Oh, I hope he wasn't. I hope he didn't hang up out of anger.
Oh, I thought he wasn't on the line. Okay.
Okay. Is that it? I guess that's the
yeah.
end of our show.
Yeah.
I really okay. enjoyed you. Can you make arrangements to come back on our show?
Sure. Yeah. Just
I really
let me know when you. Huh?
I want to talk about your poet book.
Okay.
Your experience in college during the 60s.
Okay, well, just let me know when you want me to come back.
All right, I'll give you a buzz, and I enjoyed myself immensely. You had you had several people on in the chat room the entire time.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
You had at least we had about 7 visitors, and 4 stayed the entire time. That never has happened in my experience.
Okay, well, that's great.
That's an excellent sign.
Yeah,
so
well, that's
thank
good.
Thank you again, Mr. Hudson, and enjoy your holiday. Tell your wife.
Okay.
Hello, and I'm definitely going to call you again. We have to finish this conversation.
Okay. I'd love to do that.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.